What a matchup!
And what a team, Mike. Metro PCS and the iPhone SE for $0 on a network that covers 99% of people in the U.S. Oh, impressive.
Play with the best. Switch to Metro PCS on an unlimited LTE plan and get a 32-gig iPhone SE for $0. Metro PCS. Coverage not available in some areas, plus sales tax. Claim based on talk and text. Not valid for active numbers currently on the T-Mobile network or active on Metro PCS in the past 90 days. See store for details and terms and conditions.
And now, the longest-running program in the history of 77 WABC, Religion on the Line, with Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick.
Good morning and welcome to Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
I'm Deacon Kevin McCormick.
Deacon, you wouldn't believe this. I'm walking down the street. There's a guy yelling at all of us, calling us sinners. I said, Justice Scalia, take it easy. You know, I know you were upset by the decision, but my God.
Some of his, I looked at it very briefly, and one of his footnotes is just like, it's almost unprofessional.
I don't think they went out for dinner after the decision.
No.
I have a feeling that they kind of walked out separate doors. Look, I don't think there's that much to discuss on the issue, except the following, as far as I'm concerned. We in the Jewish community have different positions. How unusual for us. There are those opposed to the decision, those in favor of the decision. But I think the one thing that it is a must is there needs to be respect here. Obviously, the court has ruled now that gay marriage is legal in all the states. Okay, that's over with now. But those who are opposed to it, there are people on theological grounds. I mean, there are traditions that clearly state this is not acceptable. Well, those people should not be seen as homophobic, as hate mongers, you know, and all the other labels that are attached to them. So I would hope, look, gay people now have the right to marry. Those who are opposed to it have a right to be opposed to it, and let's move on.
We, the church is very strong in its opinion on this because it defines marriage in a very particular way.
Right.
Men and women, complementary. It has a whole background of its theology. At the same time, the church is also very strong in saying the respect is necessary for these people. And all people, not these people, all people. And so in the conversation, as you say, these can't roll into ad hominem attacks and destructions. The fact is that this is the law right now. We have a right as citizens to approach it the way we want to, like way we the Catholic community has with Roe v. Wade. But the minute, the second, the microsecond that we start to disrespect the people here, the gay men and women, then we have real problems, and that's Absolutely. Where we have to hold it on. And remember that our job is to be out there for people, and it's the best we can do. The church is very clear in its decision, in its opinion, in its approach to marriage.
Look, I read the different positions of the Jewish community, and you know how you have the Orthodox, which is opposed, conservative, you have yes and no. There are those in the conservative movement who are opposed, and those who favor it, Reform favor it, and
get here, Orthodox and Reform disagree?
And you got to be comfortable with your position. But if your position is predicated on respect for your faith, there's nothing wrong with it. You know, if anything, you know, you have the right to practice your faith. Hopefully that's protected by the Constitution. And if this is something that you find objectionable, then so be it. But that doesn't give you the right to denigrate people who are different. They have a right to live. They now have a right to marry. I guarantee you, Kevin, our kids are not going to be talking about this issue.
No, you're right. And this is, we saw it in Ireland as well. The question becomes, and some of the bishops in Ireland were asking this question, is how did our voice become so muffled? Why is it that the church's voice is not stronger in this? And maybe that's the question we have to spend time on. We can say whatever we want, but if people aren't hearing it, that becomes a problem. And that's an internal thing that the church is going to have to come to terms
with. And also,
I
think we also see, for example, from a Jewish standpoint, that there are many who see tradition as evolving. It's an evolving tradition. You know, years ago, there were harsh punishments for a public violation of the Sabbath, for rebellious children. Things have changed. Refusal to give a Jewish divorce to a wife. There was no way out. Now there is. So we do change in the eyes of many. And others say, no, look, there are certain fundamentals that you can't change here. So whatever the point of view is, we can sit in a room together, we can discuss it, debate it, but we can't dismiss people who are different and say they are less than human. That's unacceptable.
It's a done deal.
All right.
We got a lot to do today.
We got some excellent guests here. The Reverend V. Simpson Turner is going to be with us. He's at Mount Carmel Baptist Church in Brooklyn. I knew his father.
Wow.
Great preacher. Great preacher. He's also chaplain of FDNY. He just came back from the funeral at Mother Emanuel Church in South Carolina. And Ido Aroni, we're going to talk about Israel. Great trip with Mariano I just had. And Borough President Eric Adams about the new policing guidelines. So there's much to discuss on this day. Let's pause.
Let's get to it.
These messages. Welcome back, Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Atasman.
I'm Deacon Kevin McCormack.
We are honored to have on the conference line a good friend, the Reverend V. Simpson Turner, Jr., pastor of the Mount Carmel Baptist Church in Brooklyn, chaplain for FDNY. And I was privileged to know his father, who was an extraordinary preacher. Good morning, Reverend Turner.
Good morning, Rabbi. Good morning, Deacon.
Thanks for being with us. It must have been an emotionally draining and uplifting service at that church when you sat through it.
It certainly was. It certainly was. And it was a historic event and something that we will never, ever forget.
Now, why did you attend?
Well, I attended simply because I knew Reverend Clemente Pinckney. I had met him several years ago and had an opportunity to sit down and discuss some things pertaining to the issues going on in South Carolina, and I found him to be an individual who loved humanity. He did not just love people from his own race, but he loved all people, and was certainly instrumental in helping not only his district, but the entire state of South Carolina. And so after the tragic incident, I felt compelled that I would go down and certainly honor this man who was a great statesman for the state of South Carolina as well as for the United States of America.
Could you talk for a moment about that Confederate flag? There's been so much discussion about it. When you see the Confederate flag, what reaction do you have?
Well, I have certainly had a chance to speak on it the other day when we had the unity ceremony at headquarters at the FDNY. The Confederate flag certainly has for several years represented racial intolerance. It certainly has represented oppression. And I think as the president spoke so eloquently about it, it certainly even represented that the idea of Jim Crow and all of the stigmas with Jim Crow, and it's certainly something that is very offensive, not only to me, but certainly to all fair-minded people here in America.
We're speaking with Reverend V. Simpson Turner, who is the pastor at the Mount Carmel Baptist Church in Brooklyn. He's also a chaplain with FDNY. Reverend, it's great to have you on this morning, and thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Deacon.
The question I have for you is going back to the funeral. I was so taken back by the, I don't know if it's the right legal word, the arraignment, but when the judge asked the people if they wanted to have something to say, leaving the judge aside, I was so taken by the Christian witness of the people who were there, and the key thing continually was forgiveness. We forgive you. And the one woman who I was so proud of, I'd love to meet her someday, who said, "I'm a work in progress, but I'm still trying to forgive you." Was that theme carried over into the funeral, or was it about the life of the Reverend?
No, it was certainly in the forefront. And let me go back to say that the example of the families who actually, when they were in court and they were confronted with this individual, the idea that they forgave, which was certainly something that was based upon their religious beliefs, and it was also exemplified at the funeral where various speakers as well as the crowd that was there, we rallied around the issue of forgiveness, simply because the life of the individual, Reverend Clemente Pinckney, exuded forgiveness and love to not only the state of South Carolina, but to humanity, as I spoke before. And so that was the main theme, and it was something that was certainly appreciated, because many of us understand that in our houses of worship, no matter what faith we are, we believe that we should forgive someone when they have certainly done something that is incomprehensible, but in essence is wrong. And so that was the main theme there, forgiveness, love, and then also reconciliation. Certainly that was something that we expected when we went there.
When you look at the way Christianity or any religion, you know, people take religion seriously, is taken into the media, the way it's portrayed on television and stuff, we often are stereotyped into a two-dimensional cartoon character, and people know what a Christian means, and they proclaim it in a way in which obviously makes us look pretty bad, usually. And yet, when I see the witness of these people down in South Carolina, you know, people who are burdened with a cross of tears and loss, and turn around and say, "No, it's not about us. It's not even about our suffering. It's about something greater than ourselves." I can't recall a greater witness in my over 50 years of being a Christian, and it's very, very powerful. And I think, you know, these martyrs to the faith, and I think they would certainly constitute martyrs, because they were praying in the midst of this slaughter. They truly become saints for us to emulate and to be challenged by.
Yes, and I agree with that, and I also believe that it was very interesting when the President of the United States talked about that these persons, when the individual came, what he initially decided that he was trying to do, that he was being used by God, and he didn't know it, that the act that he committed would not have the purposes which he intended, but then would be changed, and then would bring about this nationwide outcry of unity and certainly forgiveness and love. So so that was something that, from the theological perspective, that came from the President of the United States about the intention of this individual, and then how it came about to unify and certainly cause the entire nation to recognize that we must come together, and we also must forgive, and we must recognize that there are more things that unite us than the things that separate us.
We're speaking with Reverend V. Simpson Turner, Jr., pastor of Mount Carmel Baptist Church in Brooklyn, chaplain of FDNY. I was listening to a reverend from the Chicago Theological Seminary speak, and she made an interesting observation. She said, you know, people focus on the grace part, but what they may not have heard is that these people were also talking about repentance, that when someone says forgiveness in the through the Christian lens, it doesn't mean the person is innocent of the crime.
Correct.
Right?
We never said that. Yeah, right.
Yeah, because I think some people think, oh, I forgive you means, all right, the slate is clear. You know, you now get a pass. You go on. She says there's no such thing as easy grace in her eyes. That grace also comes with a responsibility to change your ways. And people heard one part. She said, I hope they also heard the other part.
Yes, and see, that was also what was constituted at the court session. And that's where my focus was. When the family members were saying to the individual who committed the act that we forgive you, within that context was that the idea of this idea of forgiveness, it's also a symbol to show you that what this individual intended to do, we then say we forgive you, but also we are expecting you to ask for forgiveness in order to understand that you have committed this injustice, but also so that there can be a healing for the individual. Because the forgiveness that these, the mourners and certainly the family members did, when they gave forgiveness, they've already said that we are healed, even in the midst of this circumstance, regarding our anger or anything towards you. But now the onus is upon you to recognize that, yes, you, through this lens, you must repent in order to heal and start the healing process for the individual.
But Rabbi, that conversion is not on the individuals who did the initial forgiving. It's on the individual who committed the heinous crime. And so the Christian did their job. They said, you know, we forgive you, and there is an expectation of justice that would go with it. But the mercy is primary. The cheap grace that the Reverend speaks to kind of echoes what Bonhoeffer spoke about in the 30s, is the idea that for the individual, you know, so in this case it would be Roof, that he has to realize that it's not like, okay, it's no big deal. He has a monumental mm-hmm. conversion that has to go through, where the individuals, it's not, they've done their job.
Yeah, you know, V. Simpson Turner, I was thinking during this, it was a teaching moment. We in the Jewish world, we look at grace, forgiveness, you know, through our lens. You look at it obviously through yours. But it was an opportunity to hear and see the hearts and heads of other people, mm-hmm. right? You know, you pick up the papers. Look, you just had here during Ramadan, you have three explosions going on. You know, a mosque in Kuwait. And here you have a story of a shooting in South Carolina, and yet concomitant with the shooting, a community comes together. And what a moment that was for this nation to see that we are not going to be deterred in our dedication to our faith. At the same time, we need to have a serious conversation about the racism that pervades too many hearts in too many places, and stop avoiding that conversation. Because I think there's this tendency to gloss over it and just say, oh, this was a lone wolf. You know, this doesn't typify every person. No one's saying it typifies everyone. But we can't deny that racism is out there.
Yes, and I firmly believe that was one of the things that were as echoed by our president in his eulogy, was the idea that we've for so long ignored the fact that it exists, and that's one of the things that I firmly believe within the context of forgiveness, that a lot of us have said, okay, we've forgiven this individual, now we're ready to move on to the future, and one of the aspects of moving on towards our future is the removal of the state flag, which the governor of South Carolina has already spoken about. The president certainly talked about it, and many in the political arena as well as in the religious arena have asked for this removal because it is a part of us moving towards our future. Because one of the things outlying in this tragedy was that this young man was so young that he wasn't even from my generation or from your generation. He was so young, and so we see how the vestiges of racism have even infected, as the president says, sometimes it infects some people when they don't really even know it. But this young man was so young, so what we're saying now is that we need the removal of the symbol so that we can move on, so that future generations, and as we go on, that the future generations will not be infected as this young man was.
All right. The Reverend V. Simpson Turner, Jr., pastor of Mount Carmel Baptist Church, chaplain of FDNY. It's a pleasure, really, to know you. It's a privilege to know you, an honor to serve with you at FDNY. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And now, the longest-running program in the history of 77 WABC, Religion on the Line, with Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
I'm Deacon Kevin McCormick.
After spending 5 days in Israel with Mariano Rivera, all I say is go Yanks. Oh, you don't really believe I mean that, do you?
All weekend long, I've been sitting looking at your freaking pictures. I mean, come on. No, it's very exciting.
I want to say thank you. We have on the comments line Consul General of Israel in New York, the Honorable Ambassador Ido Aharoni. And let me begin on behalf of Mariano, on behalf of his family, myself, thank you. Thank you for making this trip extraordinary. I mean, every visit to Israel is special. This, I think, was extraordinary because I got a chance to see it through, you know, Mariano's eyes and saw the transformation. He loved Israel. Now he wants to go back again. But when you're there, he had a chance, you know, up front to see exactly what goes on and to be able to go as a Christian to Christian sites and to go to Jewish sites. I mean, we stood together at the wall. You know, we were in Capernaum. And just to be able to say, I love my own tradition and I respect yours, that to me is a great moment in religious history.
Well, yes, I think Israel will do that to a newcomer. And this was his first visit to Israel. He went there with his entire family. And I can tell you, nothing pleases us more than the knowledge that someone of his caliber, of his stature, went to Israel, had a good time, was a meaningful visit. You know, they say that over 80% of the kids that go on Birthright, that program that sends people to a 10-day educational trip to Israel for free, 80% of them come back and say this was a life-changing experience.
The only thing that bothered him was people kept saying, who's the guy next to Potasnik? You know, but
tell me about it.
So, you know, he turned to me at one point. He said, look at this land. And we went up to the Golan Heights. We looked out. We, you know, could see from afar where Lebanon was and Syria was. And he said, there you have all this fighting. Or you look at Gaza and you see all of, you know, what goes on there, the expressions of destruction, the willingness to confront and battle. They say they could have a much better life. And they choose not to take that path. They could live like Israel in terms of having a much better way for their kids. And yet there's an ideology that infects their thinking, and they just don't want to live in peace.
Well, you know, it's we've discussed this many times. I think it's a deeply rooted phenomenon called a lack of accountability. If you notice, there's always the other who's to blame. And I think that culturally, that's really the number one impediment. When you look at what makes Israel unique is that the very ability to be self-critical, to be self-reflective, always to thrive, to excel, to do better. Unfortunately, when you read the press of our neighboring countries, you see very little public criticism of the government, very little public discourse about what we can do better as a society, and I think that's a very, very big obstacle.
We're speaking with Consul General Ida Haroni of the Israeli consulate, and we're also talking about the trip that the rabbi took with Mariano Rivera. And what I'd like to know, if we could just shift just a little bit back to the original conversation, Consul General, Christians love to visit Israel. It's a place that obviously, you know, our faith is founded on. Our gospels are all rooted in that geography. Can you just talk a little bit more? I go backwards a little bit, and I apologize for that. But and talk about what a Christian would encounter when they go to Israel.
Well, first of all, they will find the only country in the Middle East that protects the rights of other Christians to have complete and absolute freedom of worship. Not just Christian, all religions, but Christians will find a country that safeguards the holy places to Christianity. They'll find an open, pluralistic, vibrant, democratic society. They will find something that they can relate to, and I can tell you again that the satisfaction ratio is skyrocketing.
We had last time we spoke, I spoke about a former student of mine, Ryan McAvoy, and he was there. And again, the thing that I just want to underline is how he was able to say, I was 2,000 years in the past in the day, and then I was in the 21st century in the night. And the ability to be able to study, to be able to really just literally touch the very stones of the patriarchs and of the disciples, and at the same time then have a wonderful dinner and enjoy a, you know, night out with his friends, and do that in a way that was very, very safe, very, very, very wonderful. He still speaks about it.
Yes, and as I said before, this is a place that, if only given a chance, delivers in a very big way. The key is to give this place a chance not to be intimidated by the headlines and just to make a decision to go. The experience is overwhelmingly positive for tourists.
Yeah, you know, I said to Mariano, I said, obviously, if you read the New York Times, you don't fully know Israel. And that's true of many publications, that if you just watch the media, you don't see the day-to-day stories. You don't see Arabs and Jews who cooperate with one another. I mean, you walk through Jerusalem, you see all the different denominations who, exchange. And I mean, there are problems. There's no society free of problems. But yet there is an openness, and you can walk proudly in your faith and not be persecuted by someone who says you don't have a right to live. That being said, the neighborhood is a dangerous one. There's now talk that there were some threats made by ISIS in Jerusalem to Christians to get out. You have an Iranian agreement that so far, I mean, all the reports are that this is not going to, really have the safeguards necessary to protect Israel. It's seen by many as a weak agreement. Nuclear infrastructure stays in place. And yet the people of Israel, they also are determined to live. But how do you deal with those issues?
Well, we have to do the thing that we've been doing all along, and that is to safeguard our interests, to keep and monitor the situation around us very, very closely. We're looking at, by and large, two major threats. The first, as you mentioned correctly, is the Iranian nuclear program. There's an agreement that is going to be signed or concluded very, very soon. We made our position very well known on this issue. We think that the idea of allowing the world's most dangerous regime, the number one producer of terrorism in the world, to have them gain access to the world's most dangerous weapon, we believe is a very bad idea. And the second thing that is happening in our region is, of course, the disintegration of the Arab states around us. Right now, when you look at the Middle East and also parts of Africa, you see that there are, when you look at the Arab League, there are at least six Arab states that meet the criteria of failed state, which means a country that cannot provide services, basic services to its citizens. This is a, for us, it's a challenge. It contributes greatly to the uncertainty and the instability of the region. Of course, the rise of ISIS is only part of that story of the disintegration and the realignment, if you may, of the boundaries in the Middle East. We have to realize that the nations, most of the nations in the Middle East, were created between the two wars and as a result of international agreements signed by the powers of the time, most notably France and England. The problem was that those agreements, like the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916, completely and absolutely ignored ethnic and religious and tribal affiliations. And now you could say, I think pretty safely, that the Middle East is realigning itself along to these lines, and you see it all over the place. You see it in Iraq, you see it in Syria. Sudan is already split into two. You see it in Libya. You see it in Yemen and certainly other places.
So what you see also is that if you're thinking of signing an agreement with your enemy, you got to think twice that your enemy may change to a worse enemy, right? I mean, you talk to your Palestinians living in the West Bank are aligned with Hamas in Gaza. So here you are, want an agreement, and then you don't know what you're going to get.
Right. So we're used to Western kind of thinking, which is all about the rule of law, the loyalty to the nation, and so on, the institutions that are meant to provide the basic services and needs for the citizens. But what do you do when the system is falling apart? What do you do when the system, instead of having one government, has 50 different tribes? What do you do when the system is being thrown into a very long period of infighting and bloodshed, like what we see in Syria? To me, it's mind-boggling that the world that what's happening in Syria is not on the top of the agenda. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people that died, millions of people that were displaced. There's a new refugee phenomenon that threatens the stability of other regimes in the region. And very little coverage in the Western media of what's happening in Syria. To me, it's mind-boggling.
There's a article that I think is must-reading, the New York Times. Let me quote the Times. Richard Kemp, I don't know if you saw the piece, and this was a commander of British forces in Afghanistan. And what he's saying is he looked at the behavior of the Israeli army in Gaza, and he said they behaved in the most moral fashion. I know the UN will always, every chance they get to slam Israel will do so. But here you have Kemp who said, look, I looked at the behavior. I studied it. And you can be proud of the way, the army did react. Obviously, there were casualties, and nobody wants to see innocent people lost. But Israel didn't start the war with Gaza.
Well, Israel did not cooperate with this so-called investigation. But I have to tell you, there is no more critical group of people in the world when it comes to Israel than the Israelis themselves. There is no more critical institution that looks at Israel's performance more than the Israeli government and the Israeli legislature and the Israeli media themselves. We really don't need the United Nations to supervise our actions. We do it ourselves, and we have a very strong legal system. Israeli Supreme Court is known all over the world for its stature, for its rulings. And I have to tell you that time and again, we find that the international community, in this case represented by the United Nations, is not coming to the discussion with good faith and clean hands. In this case, for example, they appointed the committee with the head of the committee, someone who has a long past of very controversial statements when it comes to Israel.
All right, before I let you go, so the deacon has never been to Israel. We got Mariano going, so many others going.
Well, I'm not famous, Amari, so I'm not a famous Yankee, so no wonder.
So now we got to get the deacon to go. That's our next challenge.
Isn't there a program for that, deacons to Israel or something?
Delivering deacons to Israel.
DTI.
All right.
I think if you won't go to Israel, Deacon, I'm afraid people will be rioting out there. So we need to get you there as soon as we can. Maybe when Mariano goes again, you'll go with him.
Well, Joe said I could carry their bags, which you said, you know, was an interesting idea. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. I got to tell you one quick story. So we're in the hotel in Tel Aviv, and people are surrounding Mariano. They want autographs. And as a woman comes out of the jewelry store, she, the manager, and she says, look, I moved here. I made Aliyah. I came to Israel from California. I really don't know sports, but, you know, I know a little bit of basketball. Who is he? I said, it's Kobe Bryant. I'm sure you know if I wanted a signature. Anyway, just a great.
He's a very bad man. Can we just say you're a very bad person?
But it was, but you know, his wife, Mariano's wife, is a pastor, and she's preaching today in her church. And I can tell you there'll be no more supportive sermon given about Israel than today by Pastor Clara Rivera at their church in Westchester. They all came back. Family from Panama was there. The in-laws, his parents, his kids, everybody came back so enamored of Israel that it was a great moment. And you should be proud. I just want to say thank you to you again, Ambassador Aharoni. I want to say thank you to your chief of staff, Francine, to Keith Kantrowitz, who facilitated a lot of the meeting that took place here. You made someone's life even more special. And for that, we are all grateful.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you, Deacon.
Be well.
Bye-bye.
Be well. Bye-bye.
You too. Welcome back, Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potowski.
I'm Deacon Kevin McCormick.
Can I ask this question? Let me ask the question. If you're a winner with Publishers Clearinghouse, why can't you just get one letter, say you won? Why do you have to fill out 28 forms, you know, get all these different, you know, sales pitches? Just yes or no.
You know what I love about you, Rabbi, is you ask the big questions at the right time.
This is what bothers me.
I can see.
I stay up at night thinking about Publishers Clearinghouse. Because I like many others. I'm sure you do. Yeah. You get all this mail. This is just a waste of time.
Well, what a great segue into what I'd like to ask a question about, and that's New York State.
Yeah.
Two questions that
Please.
Come to mind. Yeah. So first of all, I'd like to thank the new Speaker of the House for once again shutting down the tax credit that would have gone to people who could give to education, both public and private, not just Catholic or Jewish or Protestant, but it would have been all private schools and all public schools. And once again, they were held hostage by the teachers union. And even though the governor was behind it, most of the legislature was behind it, they once again messed that up. And I just can't. I can't thank them enough.
Well, you're assuming the teachers' union is only pro kids.
Well, and I also don't want to confuse the teachers with their union, because I know a lot of great teachers in the public and private system who do dedicate their whole lives to their kids. But the union has an agenda that keep mediocrity. And well done. I just want to. I want to compliment you on the great job.
You know, if they had a great record, track record, you know, they could say, look, we have a superior program, therefore you don't need this. Look at what we're offering. They can't say that.
No.
They can't say that. And there are people who want choice. Interestingly, minority communities run to charter schools.
And
right?
Catholics. I know parents who are going to five jobs to allow their kids to get into a Catholic school. And they're not Catholics, but they want to do it because they know what we have. The second thing, as we just come up to the news, is bravo to the regents, the Board of Regents. The Algebra 1 Common Core math exam had 86 questions. Mm-hmm. If you passed 30 of the questions, 30 out of 86, you were given a 65%. If you passed 60 of the 86, you were given a 75%. So it makes no sense. It makes no sense.
That's a new math.
Whatsoever.
It's a new math.
No, you know what that is? Let's protect our stats so school can say, oh, we had 85% passing rate, but how many got in the 70s, 80s, and 90s? It baffles me.
Well, you know, you mentioned, I think of the great Herman Badillo and the fight he had in terms of maintaining standards. It was City University. And you mentioned today merit standards, passing tests, not getting social promotions, not watering down. And people look at you like, how dare you? How dare you? What you're doing is you're being cruel when you don't have standards because you are really directing people towards failure. Because when they get out in the real world and they've been just, you know, everything's been sugarcoated, everything's been diluted, that's not the way the real world works, and they're going to fail. And this is
It wasn't done under compassion. It was done under the CYA, and that's the whole thing behind it. It's a disgrace, absolute disgrace, in case you wonder how I felt about that.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I guess we should see what Buzz wants to say now.
Yeah.
It's Buzz time.
CYA. Yeah, please don't. Please don't explain the
word. I have nothing to say. I've never been bleeped. Never been bleeped.
Yeah, until.
Until today.
All right. Welcome back, Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Attaster.
I'm Deacon Kevin McCormick.
You know, Eric Adams' parents said to him one day, you know, you can become president in this country. And he fulfilled their, you know, their plan.
This is just the beginning. Just the beginning. Watch this meteor rise.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to be with him. And we're referring to Brooklyn Borough President, our President, Eric L. Adams. Good morning, President Adams.
Good morning, Rabbi. Good morning, Deacon.
All right.
Good to hear from you both.
Thank you.
Could you talk about the new recommendation from NYPD regarding policing, neighborhood policing, the sector? I think it's a sector commander, a sector leader. What this really means?
Excuse me. It is really an excellent opportunity to reengage the good people of our various communities and our good police officers. There has always been this wall of uncertainty. And a lot of it had to do with the fear of corruption. There was a model or policing style that stated if a community gets too close to a police officer, it opens the door for corruption. You know, first it starts with a free cup of coffee, then a free donut, then, you know, graft. And that model is really outdated, and it's really not effective if you want to build strong community relationships with their police department. And the commissioner recognizes that. And so he's going to roll out a new style of policing where officers and police and community residents will have an opportunity to really engage, identify problems, utilize the other agencies in the city to correct those problems that are outside the law enforcement arena, and really just start digging in deep and building, you know, really solid relationships.
Isn't this going back, in a way, to the old model? I remember when I was growing up, we knew the cops in the neighborhood. They would stop, we'd schmooze. My father had a retail store. They would come in, and you really felt, you know, close to one another. There wasn't this instant fear when you saw the cop. You knew he was also coming in to talk to you, to get to know you better. You get to know him better. I knew his kids. You know, in that sense, there was more development of communication and comfort with one another. Isn't that what this is doing?
He had a vested interest in the community.
Yeah.
No, so true. And I don't know what happened over the years that officer friendly turned into officer enemy, and residents no longer became happy to see their officer walk down the street and was able to call by his name. That was part of the problem of really with the heavy introduction of, you know, radio motor patrols, what they call RMP police cruisers. You're really just driving by communities instead of walking and having that vested interest. And a good relationship between the police and the community is proactive policing, because if I know my cop on the corner, I am more inclined to tell him about a criminal action that's taking place, and being there to make sure that, you know, it's a partnership to provide a safe environment.
What are some of the measures that need to be taken to break down that breakdown of trust? In other words, to get communities to be open to one another. I mean, where you have this hesitation, where you have this mistrust, how do you now begin to change the dynamics?
And you know what? The answer is so simple that we have made it complicated. Imagine if you have an officer that stands on your corner and every morning you walk out towards the train station to go to your place of employment, and he simply smiles and say, "Good morning, ma'am. How are you? Have a safe day." That person remembers that for the entire day. There's something that happens when the symbol of public safety greet you in a kind way, and you are a person that supports public safety. I told my young brother that when he first started policing, he was very afraid in the Lower East Side in Operation Pressure Point by Williamsburg. He was so afraid that he wanted to quit the second day on patrol. And I went and walked patrol with him off duty and told him, just say hello to the people. And when he started doing that and he saw the response, how people just greeted him with a smile, and they were so happy that he was saying hello, that it changed his entire outlook on what it meant to be a police officer. And so if we start engaging and just saying good morning, talking about some of our great city programs, municipal ID, pre-K enrollment, and just engage with the public, it would change within a month or 2 month period. You'll see a different dynamic in the cities, even in the most high crime precincts.
Well, some critics have said, you know, what you're doing is you're reducing police, or you're changing police to social workers. You're watering down the feel-good stuff, but it's not really effective crime fighting. What do you say to that?
But that's what we are, believe it or not. Any given day in one tour, we can go from talking down an emotionally disturbed person. We could give comfort to a family member who lost a child. We're called if someone had a cat up a tree. We're the first respondents there to determine what mechanism will be used to bring that cat down. Are we going to call the ASPCA or the fire department? And so now we are actually making these methods of being the first responder and make the first determination of what city response is. We are building it into the fabric of the police department. So we are just that. We are the persons, the individuals that make those determinations of how do we utilize city resources to correct a condition. Policing is not just catching bad guys. It's correcting conditions. That could be a protest. It could be someone making too much noise. The method of a police department is to correct the condition and use the necessary force to correct that condition without hurting any innocent person or even a person that's causing the condition.
We're speaking with Brooklyn Borough President Eric L. Adams, and we're talking about a lot of stuff, particularly right now, the expansion of the police department and having greater social capital with the police, where they know the people's names, they're involved in the community. This was done in the 80s. I just had Dom Lorendi text me about 18 different texts. He's a retired police officer, works with me at Severian. And in the 80s, they said they put cops in the classroom, in the high schools, not to be patrolling, but to teach, to so kids would know who the cops were, and they would work together on this stuff. And I think that makes a lot of sense, that when you have social interaction, when you have this ability to say that Officer McCormick or Officer Adams or Officer Potasnik is a guy who I know and I can go to, that breaks down so many barriers. And I commend, if this is the direction it's going to go, I know Bratton had done this before, and I hope it continues.
And that's so true. And I love, Deacon, I love the terminology, the term you just used, social assets, I believe you said.
Social capital.
Social capital. Because you're right. That capital can be used, and it gathers interest, and it allows us to use it when we need it. So let's say we do have an unfortunate shooting that involves a mistake of shooting an innocent person. When you have that social capital, the community will respond differently. But right now, officers are afraid to say good morning to a resident, and residents are afraid to say good morning to an officer. So the good people of our city are afraid to communicate with each other, and the first sign of respect is communication. Hello, a smile, a handshake, an invitation. Nothing would be greater in a city if I walk past an officer and say, congratulations, I heard your son graduated from college last week. Those are the type of relationships that we need. Or if an officer says to a passing resident, good luck to you, I heard your son and daughter just got married. That is what we need. The police officers are not our enemy, and the overwhelming 99% of the people who live in even high crime areas, they're not the enemy. They want the bad guy removed from their community, just like the police department.
Now, we just have a few more minutes, but I want to change the subject a little bit. And I saw you in the Post this morning. Talking about
in a good way,
a very good way,
on the front page. Yeah.
Let me frame this question quickly. Yeah. I have permanent black and blue marks on my shins because when we go to family parties or social functions, and inevitably, once in a while, a conversation on Robert E. Lee comes up. I think Kevin McCormick, only speaking for myself, I think Robert E. Lee is a traitor. He was trained by West Point. He was an American citizen. He fought against the correct government at the time. And the fact that he's a hero has always driven me crazy. The fact that John Adams is not considered a great president, but that Jefferson is, despite the fact that Jefferson owned people, is never spoken of. And I am so excited that at least now we can bring up the topic of maybe we don't need Stonewall Jackson, a Confederate general, being honored. Or Robert E. Lee, who personally, again, I'm only speaking for myself, and you can go on our Facebook page and rip me apart, but was a traitor. You know, Virginia was more important than the United States.
And slavery was an essential part of their DNA.
Essential. Yeah. It was the core state right. So anyway, enough about me, and people can beat me up.
Never enough.
But thank you for starting to ask these questions.
And that's what we're doing. And I take my hat off when I sit down and talk to some of my Jewish brothers and sisters, and they share with me how, although the Holocaust was several years, they're not going to allow people to live in the shadows of their actions and just merge into government as though it never happened. And I think we should look at all of these historical monuments and buildings, those who participated in the Holocaust, those who participated in destroying Catholic properties or harming someone because of their religion, those who participated in slavery. Those people should remain in history books so we can document those incidents, but they should not remain on historical buildings or on streets so that we pretend that it did not exist. We must purge our history of those who have participated in anything that harmed people because of their religion, their race, their ethnicity. And the one way to do it is to have historians go back and look at some of these streets, some of these buildings, and determine, are these people the real heroes that we believe they are? And they aren't, their names should be removed.
I was reading a report that Amazon.com, you can buy Nazi insignia. Now they're going to remove the Confederate insignia, but Nazi insignia still remains. And as a Jew, it's unacceptable. It's morally repulsive that people would sell, you know, Nazi kinds of emblems.
That's so true, and that is why I join anytime I see anti-Semitism or anti any group. I join them because we are united. The good people of this country, we are united around the belief that we cannot reward behavior that is harmful to any group.
All right. You know, that means, Deacon, there'll be a few streets left for naming. So, you know, I don't have to say any more than that. You know, enough said.
You're shameless. You're shameless. Yeah, although if you do, McCormick is with an A, not an I.
Yeah. But, you know, you've come in as borough president. You've done a lot. And you got a great future ahead of you. And we're just happy to share these special moments with you. Thanks so much for being with us. And hope to see you soon.
And I appreciate you both. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Rabbi Joseph Potasnik at 77 WABC.
Welcome back, Religion on the Line. I'm Rabbi Joseph Petit.
Attaboy.
And so, you know, when you're on jet lag.
Yeah, and if I did that, you would say, where were you last night, Kev? Where were you last night,
yeah,
Joe?
Yeah, but you know where I was last night. I have certain questions, but mm-hmm. me, I'm just home reading the good book. You know, we have many, many special people listen to the show.
We do.
Today, we'd like to think everybody's special. But today,
who do we
the
have?
Audience is enhanced by the listenership of the great Lauren McCormick.
She's a very special woman.
And now, I just want to know one thing. Your daughter, Lauren, now she's up now, obviously, listening.
She's actually traveling.
Is she getting home now? Or?
No. She's going into the big parade today. She's going to celebrate in the big parade today with her friends.
That's very nice. You know, I remember when I would come home very late, and sometimes I'd come home so late, my father was just getting up to go to services in the synagogue, and he would see me in the room, and the lights were on, I was dressed, he says, what's going on? I said, Dad, I want to go to shul with you. And I'd have to go to synagogue with him early in the morning because I didn't want to tell him I just got home.
Yeah, that wouldn't have flown with my father.
That generation.
No,
now if your kids come home like 3 in the morning, you'd have a good time.
Yeah. But if I can just brag a little bit about her, I mean, Lauren does great work. She works with the diocese as far as the working and helping to raise money with Changing Our World. Not Changing Our World, with it's. I'm
we
missing
last
it.
Last night. Yeah.
Good point. But you know what? She works especially with adults who are disabled. I'm trying. We used to use a word that we don't use anymore, but these are developmentally challenged young men and women in their 40s, 50s, 60s. And Lauren spends her time with these folks, you know, helping them in their homes and doing the right thing. And I'm proud of all my kids, but since we're talking about Lauren, I just want to commend her for the work that she does there.
You know, I mentioned this before, but every year I look forward to participating in the special Seder, Passover Seder for the developmentally disabled in Brooklyn. Rabbi Wolliger and his family who are there they're angelic in terms of the outreach. And you look at life, and there are a lot of people out there who are on the spectrum in some way. And years ago, we would discard them. We would diminish their worth. We'd say, well, they're not like everybody else. And then we learn that we're all disabled in some way. We all have certain deficiencies. And these people are equals and are to be treated with respect. And maybe that's the message of this week, that we don't have to agree with everybody, but we need to respect people. And I think of that, you know, here I am in Israel, and I'm in Capernaum. And, you know, the Capernaum for Jews doesn't have the same meaning as it does for Christians, where Jesus preached. And I'm looking at people reading their Bible with such pride, and I'm saying, wow, what a moment this is for me to look at Christians and say how proud they are and how I respect them. And then I'm at the wall in Jerusalem, and there are Christians standing with me and seeing my, you know, my love for my tradition. This would be a better world if we could simply listen to one another, look at one another with respect. We wouldn't have some of the issues of the day. Somebody said, if we kept the Ten Commandments, we wouldn't have the 11 o'clock news.
Let's focus on the humanity and let the other stuff go.
Thank you, Mr. Michael Sevilla, our executive producer, Aaron Speck, our screener. We'll see you hopefully next week. Religion on the Line, WABC Talk Radio.
What a matchup!
And what a team, Mike. Metro PCS and the iPhone SE for $0 on a network that covers 99% of people in the U.S. Oh, impressive.
Play with the best. Switch to Metro PCS on an unlimited LTE plan and get a 32-gig iPhone SE for $0. Metro PCS.
Coverage not available in some areas, plus sales tax. Claim based on talk and text. Not valid for active numbers currently on the T-Mobile network or active on Metro PCS in the past 90 days. See store for details and terms and conditions.